quick announcement. As you know, we had our annual business meeting the 9th and elected a new deacon. And by the bylaws, we have 30 days to have a public ordination. And so if you want to mark your calendars, April 9th, which should be exactly 30 days, I think. It might be 31, I'm not sure, but you can fire me if it's 31. But because next week is the 2nd, and that would be trying to cut it a little close, I think. So April 9th, probably second session, we will do that, have our ordination ceremony for Adam Wolf.
That's a Thursday.
Oh.
April 9th is a Sunday. April 5th, maybe? I'm sorry.
Where's my calendar? Oh. I'm sorry. Okay, yes. Yes, okay. It's the 12th. All right, there you go. That's better. Well, it's the 12th. We're going to actually be a couple of days late, but that provides us enough time, and I don't think we'll get in trouble with the state if we're 2 days late. Matter of fact, next board meeting, we could actually vote to just extend that to the 9th or the 12th, rather. So we can, yeah, no wonder I thought it was 30 days. I was doing it off the 9th. Okay, so we will do that on April the 12th, and we have a board meeting on the 11th, so we will vote to extend that and deal with that. All right, let's make sure we're in fellowship, and let's continue on here dealing with the fact that, and this is one of the things you have to take into account. Obviously, in terms of grace and patience, people may not apply this immediately out of the chute like they should, and Abraham's an example of that. But ultimately, if they want to get it, they will, and they will apply it at some point. So we allow for the principle, as we always have to, of spiritual growth, that everyone comes to God's plan at various levels of understanding, and the low level of understanding isn't going to see the value and importance of all of these things, and you have to be taught. But it takes years to impart a doctrinal grid, and to get people to understand how these doctrines fit together, why they're there, why they're important in each in its own right. And that takes a long time to inculcate into somebody. It's not like learning a language or some discipline, physics or math or anything else, where there are pretty much standard time frames set for learning, and pretty much the curriculum is pretty well fixed when you're studying anything, again. But when it comes to these matters, studying doctrine, it takes believers a while to assimilate the truth. And then and believers may struggle with an individual doctrine. I remember when we first got on sound teaching, we were listening to tapes because that was all we knew at the time. But that didn't last really too very long. I think within 6 months or so, we were actually sitting under face to face by then. And so when we did that, we first started, people had trouble with some doctrine, say the doctrine of the blood. They'd been inculcated. If you've been a fundamentalist for decades and you're taught it's the literal blood of Jesus that saves. There is a fountain filled with blood drawn from Emmanuel's veins. Well, a little misleading, no. Nobody drew any blood from him. There weren't any hypodermics at that time that I know about. But they interpreted it literally. And so then you ask them any questions, they couldn't really answer. Well, which blood saves? Now, he probably bled when they were beating the daylights out of him in the Praetorian there. I'm sure he bled there. Did he never cut himself in his father's wood shop? He was a carpenter. How many carpenters, you know, never been cut? So I suspect he bled. He bled on the cross. Which blood saves us? None of it. Because the blood is a figure, just like the sword is a figure for warfare or capital punishment or other things. Blood is a figure for sacrifice. And in this case, the sacrifice of a life. That's what's really entailed by the blood. The life of the flesh for the animal is in the blood. And the blood is the life. Not for humans. Humans have soul life. And so what he sacrificed was he laid down his soul life for the human race. So Abraham, again, he didn't initially get this, didn't apply it very well. And you see that there, the command. And then you see, and that's why I backed it up there to chapter 11 to show you that this matter of, one, it's about how Moses writes, for one thing. That part's important here because you would think this is out of order if you didn't know that. But it's pretty clear here in verses 31 and 32, Terah took Abraham, his son, and Lot, and whatever other relatives he took, and they went out together. Well, this isn't what Abraham was told to do. Abraham wasn't told, hey, separate from your father's house, but take your father with you. What is the point of separating from his household if you take the father with you? And I guarantee you this was not Abraham's choice. This was forced on him. And he didn't stand up to it. And this is where sometimes in a family, the son has to stand up to the dad and tell him, butt out. No, Dad, you're not going with us. God has told me to do this and you weren't invited. And you say, well, that's cruel and that'd be hard to do. Well, sure. I'm not saying it wouldn't be hard to do, but I'm just saying that is the reality of what had to happen. And until Abraham did this, he was not blessed with the terms of the covenant until this was all finished. So he said, I will do this if, and essentially when you get into 12:1, it almost has the flavor of a conditional clause. If you go forth from your country and your relatives to the land which I will show you, then I will make you a great nation. And after I have blessed you and made your name great, and you will become a blessing. And he promises future blessing if he applies under this. But again, until it's fulfilled, the terms of the covenant are not reiterated till Abraham again. Here. So also chapter 12, verse 4. So Abraham went forth as the Lord had spoken to him. That's not quite true because Terah is with him. That's not quite exactly true. And Lot went with him. Well, that's clearly contradicted to what was told. When he said, and go forth from your country and from your relatives. Well, clearly that would have included Lot. And so, no, he didn't comply with this in the beginning like he should have. But we don't look at Abraham and say, wow, what a spiritual loser. You know, he failed, but he got over this. And God worked out the situations in his life. And I believe fully, number one, I think God killed Terah. I'm pretty sure since he controls life and death. I'm pretty sure when Terah died in Haran, God took him out. Because Abraham, I don't think, could have ever stood up to him. It didn't seem like he could. And it didn't seem like he did. He had to be taken out. And this is one of the things I tell people. If you want to play fun footsies with negative people and you want to think it's okay, God can kill them. He has life and death. He can stop this. Now, he doesn't do it in every case, obviously. God does not ever, it seems to me, he's far more patient and doesn't take that immediately extreme step of delivering you. But he can deliver you from people by killing them. And since he controls life and death, that's his purview. So this is one of the motivations I think people should understand. When it comes to separation, God can take out what you won't separate from if he chooses. Now, there's no guarantee he will do that. See, some people have said, well, if I can't really apply like I should here, but God will work it out and I'll eventually do it. There's no promise he's going to work it out for you. You have to do it at certain points. So also chapter 13. Now we jump ahead. Terah's dead. So we jump ahead. Hey, that rhymes. And so there was a problem here. And I think this is more providentially what God does. He lets this work out in a course of events between Abraham and Lot. Now he knows Abram's supposed to separate from Lot. He knows this. God's told him to. But Abram hasn't done it. And Lot, who went with Abraham, verse 5, also had flocks and herds and tents. And the land could not sustain them while dwelling together, for their possessions were so great that they were not able to remain together. There was not enough pasture land to feed all the flocks and all of that, and they would have destroyed an area. And I don't know if you know anything about sheep, but cattlemen hate sheep. Because sheep destroy pastures. They don't just eat it, they destroy them. They eat it down to the ground. Where a cow won't do that. And so there was, if you happen to see any of that show, I think it was 1883 there, or maybe 1923, the spinoff from Yellowstone, where the cattle ranchers and the sheep herders got into it. Well, it didn't end well. It ended with several deaths. Because, well, there was a lot more lawlessness, I'd say. A lot more. Can we have more lawlessness? So there was strife. They couldn't remain together. There was strife. Now their servants are fighting amongst themselves. Between Abram's livestock and the herdsmen of Lot's livestock. Now the Canaanite and the Perizzite were also dwelling in that. So you had the indigenous peoples there that were still, you know, they had flocks and all of this, and you had to kind of work around them as well. And so Abram said to Lot, "Please, let there be no strife between you and me, nor between my herdsmen and your herdsmen, for we are brothers. Is not the whole land before you? Please separate for me." The best words Abraham had spoke to that point. "Please separate from me," because this was God's will. And Abraham finally does it. But I think, again, providentially, God worked this out to where it was easier for Abraham. Now, that is true that if you have a struggle in a particular area and you've got a hump you need to get over, God may help you over that hump. Now, it may not be pleasant, you know, but he may help you. You know, that's when you're singing, "Drop, kick me, Jesus, through the goalposts of life." He may help you. But it may be painful. But in this case, I don't think it was. I think it was pretty easy for Abraham now because he saw, look, we don't need any strife. We're relatives. Let's just go our own way. And did he remember in the back of his head that God had said, "Separate from your relatives"? Did he remember that? I suspect he did. So it's not the whole land before you. Please separate from me. If you go to the left, I will go to the right. Or if you go to the right, then I will go to the left. And Lot lifted up his eyes. Now, who's Lot? Lot is a self-seeking idiot. That's who Lot is. Lot's all about Lot. Lot doesn't care about Abraham particularly, I don't think, other than they were relatives. But he's more worried about Lot. And so when given the choice, who does Lot look out for first? Lot. Lot lifted up his eyes and saw all the valley of the Jordan, and that it was well watered everywhere. And by the way, this was before the Lord destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah. Like the garden of the Lord, like the land of Egypt as you go to Zohar. And the Lord chose for, and Lot, and I, this is so well put, Lot chose for himself all the valley of the Jordan. And Lot journeyed eastward. And thus they separated from each other. Abram settled in the land of Canaan, while Lot settled in the cities of the valley and moved his tents as far as Sodom. Uh-oh. Now, the men of Sodom were exceedingly wicked and sinners against the Lord. Well, we know what their sin was. They didn't show hospitality properly. That was their sin. You know, these are horrible people. No, I think there's more to it than that. What are Sodomites? You know, I remember there was an old skit on Saturday Night Live. The city council at Sodom was meeting and said, "Well, what are we known for?" The sodomy, right? And they made jokes out of what the Bible teaches is true. I mean, they at least acknowledged that sodomy was what they're known for. And so when he finally separates, now verse 14, now the covenant is in force and effect. Abraham has complied with the two things he hadn't. The Lord said to Abram after Lot had separated from him. And he's very clear that that separation was what, he didn't talk to him till after that. He didn't reiterate this. "Now lift up your eyes and look from the place where you are, northward and southward and eastward and westward. For all the land which you see, I will give to you and your descendants forever. I will make your descendants as the dust of the earth, so that if anyone can number the dust of the earth, then your descendants can also be numbered. Arise, walk about the land through its length and breadth, for I will give it to you." And this is when the covenant was finally now in full force and effect. The Abrahamic covenant. So the believer, point N, must understand and believe the principle that God will establish sound relationships with other positive believers. And again, it's not based on personality necessarily. I mean, sure, we share something. We share all things in common in Christ. But we don't have other things in common. Come from different economic backgrounds, different military backgrounds, different cultural backgrounds, and all of that. And so, you know, everybody, as we've said before, everybody in the local church may not be your cup of tea, but they are your brother and sister and are to be treated as such, as a part of the royal family. So he will establish sound relationships with other positive believers. These are the relationships that are ultimately satisfying, since they are built on the foundation of doctrinal truth. Things built on the truth are stable. Guess what? Other things not built on the truth aren't stable necessarily. Mark 33. I was wondering why that guy with the bad hand got into this. And this is, again, I'm sorry, this is the parallel. We'd seen the parallel in Matthew. This is the parallel here. I can't remember where it is in here, but basically it says that his family had gone out to get him because they just thought he'd gone nuts. And so they were going to take him into custody for his own good because they thought he was a mental case. And then he, not only is he not a mental case, there in Mark 3:33, and actually it's a little before that, when his mother and brothers arrived. And if I would translate this here, I would say, and once they had took their stand outside, in other words, they've posted up. They said, here's where we are and you're coming to us. They're trying a power play on him. They sent word to him and called him. Your mother and your brothers are outside looking for you. And Jesus never acknowledged him, never went out. And people say, well, that's not very good manners. Well, there's a lot of things that are bad manners. But that's not bad manners in this case because he's ignoring them for a purpose. He's making a doctrinal point because he wants to reinforce on his disciples that there are more important things than family. And if I ever hear that phrase one more time, my head's going to explode. There's nothing more important than family. Yes, there is. There's a lot of things more important than family. Your family's where you came from. They gave you a start in the world and we owe them for that. Somebody took care of you when you were born. You couldn't take care of yourself. And so they are to be credited for all of that. But then once you're of age and all of that, then it becomes different. Other issues come into play. And certainly if you're a believer. And he looks around and he says, who are my brother and my mother? My mother and my brothers? Whoever does the will of God. This is, and see, people not doing the will of God, they don't show up for Bible class. They're not consistent. And yet they say, I'm right with Jesus. No, you're not. This is not correct. Don't be delusional. This gets into an issue that's slightly off of the family, but I thought had to be put in here. Dating marriage and the doctrine of separation. Under the principle that forbids being unequally yoked together. That's in 2 Corinthians 6 there. I should have put the verse in it. Believers are not to pursue or establish marital relationships with unbelievers of the opposite sex. This means you don't even date them. If they're not positive, if they're not of the same spiritual quality that you want to be of, you don't date them. They're off limits. They're unbelievers, for one thing. They're enemies of God at that point. And God doesn't really care for his children to run around with his enemies. Would you as a parent? You want your children run around with your enemies, people that have done you wrong, all of that, who hate you? No, probably you wouldn't. And God is a perfect parent in that regard. Since positive believers should avoid becoming entangled with negative believers. Now, that's different than unbelievers. Unbelievers are completely 100% off limits. There's no place for that at all. And this, the idea, and I've seen it before, the concept of missionary dating. What does that mean? It means I'm going to hook up with somebody who's negative and drag them to class and hope it works. That's not the way the Christian should approach his marital life or his dating life. Bad company corrupts good morals. One should not initiate a romantic relationship with a negative believer. They need to demonstrate what they are first. But see, people won't do this. Why? Young boys, young girls. I understand what happens at puberty. I've been through it. But I also know what happens. I see it all the time. And the reality is, they're in love or heat, not sure which, hard to tell, and sometimes both. But the reality is, they're very often in lust, not in love. I get that. I was young once. I get it. But I'm saying this is spiritually harmful now. I wasn't told this stuff. I didn't have parents that looked out for me and said, hey, this is what you need to look for in a woman. Because what do guys go out and look for? The best package. That's what they are impressed with, the overt package. And what are women looking for? God knows now. But normally it was, you know, somebody who was stable, somebody who was successful. You know, it's not unusual for women to want to marry doctors or lawyers or somebody who can provide for them. But that may be just because of their financial lust grid, their monetary lust grid. They want to marry somebody rich. So what you do is, number one, you pray about it. You don't get in any hurry. I know when you're young, it's way easier to be in a hurry. I can't even remember who it was, but there was a country song, and it was appropriate and to the point. I'm in a hurry to get things done. I rush and rush until life's no fun. And really, all I got to do is live and die. So I'm in a hurry, and I don't know why, but that's teenagers. Very often, they're in a rush. They want to live. They want to get, you know, get there, as it were. And so one of the things you learn, I wish I'd have learned it earlier in life, is that life is a journey. It's not just a destination. It's not just getting there. It's learning to live along the way. And that's 1 Corinthians 15:33. That is the deal there on bad company corrupts good morals. But again, don't be in a hurry. There's nothing to be gained by being in a hurry. Being in a hurry generally tends to lead to bad outcomes. You're careless. You're more careless when you're in a hurry. And this hurry may be built out of frustration. God's not doing what you want fast enough. That happens with young people. I want it now. You know, like, who was it? Baruch Assault? I want it now. Go watch Willy Wonka and you'll see different kinds of kids. And the impatient child. The demanding child. All of that. So, three, all believers must learn to wait on the Lord in general. And this is no more true than in the divine institution of marriage. Rushing into a bad marriage will wreck your life. It's certainly not going to make it any better. And it can have long-term catastrophic effects. There are some sins, there are some mistakes we make. And the repercussions are light. They're minor. There are other things, marriage is one of them, because it is a divine institution that people make. And then, obviously, the repercussions are longer lasting. Because if you're going to go to a biblical church that enforces the realities of doctrine, you're not going to be able to divorce and remarry and divorce and remarry and divorce and remarry. We're not going to put up with that. That's not going to be tolerated. We will tolerate failure and grant grace. But this idea, and I even heard a guy who used to go here say it. I've been divorced several times, but divorce is just a number. Is it? Is that what it is, really? Or is destruction and misery in your path? As it says in Romans 3 there. You don't know the way of peace. And there's a trail of catastrophes behind you. While you're saying divorce is just a number. That is such a callous and frivolous attitude, it made me want to vomit. And this guy is pretty messed up, but he thinks he's oriented. And but again, once you've done it once, twice, three times, it gets easier and easier and easier. And we also, and I think everybody should know the statistics by now, fully 50% of all marriages end divorce. I believe second marriages, it's more like 75 or 80% end in divorce. Third marriages, it's higher. Till eventually nobody can stay married. And then we wonder, again, what's happened to the family unit? What's happened to our society? I can tell you what's happened. Selfish people have ruined it. by serving themselves and nothing else. So further, it is better, remember, that it is better to be single, fulfilling God's plan in time, than it is to compromise doctrine and get into a relationship that may become a real cause of grief. Proverbs 11:22. Man, she's hot. How many times you heard guys say that? A ring of gold in a pig's snout, as one is, so is a beautiful woman that lacks discretion. Does she have any sense? Oh, she's pretty. But is that what you're supposed to be looking for? Or do you want quality of character? You can't see the soul, but that's what you need to be looking for. The overt package may fool you. And let me tell you something about pretty girls. They're used to getting their way, as a rule. Because people cater to them. You know, they've done this, I don't know how many times I've seen it on news segments and then studies and all of this. Handsome, pretty people get treated better. That's just a fact. And you can ignore that fact and say, well, it shouldn't be a fact. It doesn't make any difference. It's still a fact. People respond to the overt. People tend to judge overtly. And that's what Jesus said. You people judge according to appearance. I judge according to the truth. And the appearance isn't necessarily the truth. So, again, a pretty girl that doesn't have any sense. You say, well, I really want a beautiful wife. I want a trophy wife. You should want a wife that can cook. You should want a wife that can clean. You should want a wife who's disciplined and organized. You should want a wife who's loving and caring and puts other people first. And this isn't what people are looking for when they're out there in the clubs. Hey, let's get into character. What kind of character have you got? No, that never comes up. I've been young. I've been out there. I know what I'm talking about. And that's just the way it works. So again, you may get what you want overtly, but what are you going to end up with internally? A wreck in many cases. I'm not saying pretty girls can't be positive, by the way. You know, but I'm saying if they're, first, they're not, if are they in Bible class? That's the biggest question first, right off the bat. Are they in Bible class? Before you even think about establishing a relationship with them, you need to bring them to class first. Don't get involved with them and then bring them to class. That's not the right order. Proverbs also, 21:9. It is better to live in a corner of a roof. And typically their roofs were not covered. Their roofs were external to the elements. But the fact is, corner of the roof in Florida is about 140 degrees in the summer. It can be pretty warm in the winter even, but it's definitely hot in the summer. A corner of a roof in Florida is a different deal than it is to live in a house shared with a contentious woman. And by the way, I would reverse this as well. It's also better for a woman to live in a corner of a roof than to live with a contentious man. If the man's just argumentative, constantly on you and this and that, you're better off with somebody else. A contentious man's no better than a contentious woman in that sense. Also, verse 19, same chapter. It is better to live in a desert land than with a contentious and vexing woman. And women, you know, if you go into marriage and you have the idea, well, this is going to all work out and we may have a few problems, but blah, blah, blah. You could have major catastrophes and crises out of the chute. You never know what you're going to get. But a woman, a contentious woman's one that just wants to argue with you. She won't do what you ask her to do. You have to either pull rank on her or make her life miserable in some way to get her to obey. That's not what you want in a wife. And that, by the way, women, isn't who you want to be. That's a fact. So an argumentative woman that drives you nuts. Yeah, that sounds like a good marriage. That's what I shot for. No, not at all. But I was blessed, see? You talk about God gracing a person out. I got married while I was an unbeliever. And God still blessed me. He's kept me alive probably 10, 15 times that I can think of just off the top of my head. I keep telling him I'd rather be in heaven. He keeps not listening. He keeps providing living grace. And I'm assuming he expects me to keep growing, that he's not done with me yet. And so no matter how long you've been on doctrine, all of us still have room to improve, to grow, and to figure things out and apply these things. Also, chapter 27, 27:15. A constant dripping of rain on a day of steady rain. Drip, 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 drip. And a contentious woman are alike. He who would try to restrain her restrains the wind and grasps soil with his right hand. In other words, it's an exercise in futility. So, and again, I would also reverse these and point out the same thing is true, ladies of men. A contentious man's just alike. You know, drip, drip, drip. It never stops. So again, the real blessings in life come to those who honor God and apply His Word to these issues. Proverbs 19:14. And as we point out, that you know, these are the general rules. And that's what Proverbs is for. Proverbs is a book that sets forth us the normal wisdom of God and how things work in the world as a general rule. And of course, as we point out, there can be exceptions to every rule. In some ways, I'm a bit of an exception in that I married as an unbeliever and God still blessed me. But I don't counsel that to people. I don't say, hey, I made this mistake and God overcame it, so you go out and do the same thing. No, I tell them, here's the wisdom of the Bible on this matter. Here's what God says we should do. House and wealth are an inheritance from fathers. Nepo babies. But a prudent wife is from the Lord. And that's what you want, is a prudent wife. You want a shrewd wife, and not shrewd in the bad sense. Now, prudent and shrewd kind of mean the same thing, but one of them has more of a negative connotation. Whereas prudent is the one who looks ahead and sees the danger. Shrewd is the one who's trying to put something over on you. And those are different. Also, chapter 31, 10 and following. An excellent wife, who can find? For her worth is far above jewels. Why? First thing right out of the chute, her husband trusts her. If you can't turn your back on your wife, you've got a problem. If she's going to do what she's going to do and not pay attention to what you say, she's going to come under some discipline at some point. And the discipline, some of it should come from the husband. But it will come from God at some point too. But God, when God gives people authority, guess what happens if they don't use it? They come under discipline. So women can do whatever they choose to do. Wives can do whatever they choose to do. But husbands have a mandate to watch over this stuff. They are the authority in the household. The ultimate authority. So the heart of her husband trusts in her. And he will have no lack of gain. She does him good and not evil all the days of her life. She looks for wool and flax and works with her hands in delight. This obviously is a system. And I've heard people make the argument out of this. Well, see, this demonstrates that women should have jobs and work outside the home. I disagree with that only on the last part of it. This does agree that women can have jobs. But my suggestion here is when you read all this, does she go out and work a job somewhere else, or is she working within her own household and in around that household? She's overseeing everything there, as it seems. She works with her hands in delight. She is like merchant ships. She brings her food from afar. Do you take that to mean she gets on a boat and travels for days to go get food? I don't take that to mean that. I mean, this is an agrarian society. Food is perishable. She got her food right there where she lived. Because she went out to get it doesn't mean anything. Of course she goes to the market to buy things. Women still do that. Men sometimes too. She rises up while it is still night and gives food to her household. So apparently she's cooking pretty early in the day. And this is when you have, you know, now you got an empty nest deal like with me and Linda. She doesn't get up and start cooking in the morning. I don't expect her to. I don't eat until I'm getting ready to eat anyway. But if you're dealing with a family and raising children and they have to go to school, and you got to have a schedule and you have to stick to it. And the wife is obviously the focal point of all that. In my opinion, the household really revolves around her, particularly when it comes to the children. But that doesn't let the husband off the hook. And she gives portions to a mater. She considers a field and buys it. And my guess is she considers a field that's not far away. She doesn't go, you know, miles and miles and miles to go look at a field that she knows she's going to have to make that same trip every day. I think this woman's pretty shrewd. I think everything about it says this woman is prudent and thoughtful and diligent. So I don't think she would do that. You know, what's a 5-mile trip take if you're walking? If you're a woman and you may be carrying something, you know, if you can do 4 miles an hour, that's pretty good. But I think most women are probably out there walking. You're going to do like 2 miles an hour, maybe. And then if you're hauling children, it could be slower than that. So, no, I think she works right around where she lives. And from her earnings, she plants a vineyard. She girds herself with strength and makes her arms strong. She senses that her gain is good. And why she senses this, because I believe she understands God's blessing this. God's blessing me in all of this. Her lamp does not go out at night. She's up early in the morning and she's up late at night. She stretches out. She's making clothes now. First she gets up early to cook. In the evening she's doing her clothes making business, as it were. Or at least for the family. And her hands grasp the spindle. She extends her hand to the poor and stretches out her hands to the needy. She's also kind and considerate. She looks out for those less fortunate. And that's the problem today, is finding the less fortunate, the actual less fortunate that want help and helping them. Because very often what I've noticed is the panhandlers on the street, they don't want to change. They want to be doing what they're doing. And you can throw money at them as long as you want to, and it won't change the situation necessarily. But a woman is cautious, thinks about it, and helps the needy. She is not afraid of the snow for her household. I'm not afraid of it either, but I'm in Florida. We don't know where they lived. For her household are all clothed with scarlet. And these are expensive. Scarlet was an expensive thing, expensive fabric. And she makes coverings for herself. Her clothing is fine linen and purple. She buys quality stuff, too. I used to be of the opinion, this is one of the things where I grew up, and some believers helped me, but also studying Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, helped me. Because when I started reading those verses about denying yourself and laying up all your money and your funds so you can leave it to an idiot, I realized, I may not want to do that. Maybe denying myself everything and saving up money so your kids can have money. First, whoever told you in the Bible that that's what you're supposed to be doing? As a general rule, we would say, yes, parents lay up for their children. But to deny yourself everything just so they can have more, I don't think the Bible teaches that. I think it might teach the opposite. But that's what Solomon says. I've stored up, I've been rich, I've got all these things, and who will inherit them once I'm gone? And he admits, my son could well be an idiot. So that's true of everybody. People who can't handle money, you think it's wise to retire, take all your money, and then leave it to somebody who can't handle money? That's downright stupid. That's a waste of your money. It's a waste of your lifetime to do that. And so we won't. We've thought about this. We've talked about it. We have very specific things laid out in our a trust as to who gets what and when and why. And the one positive believer in our family is going to inherit a lot more than everybody else is, I can tell you that. But that's our call. And I kind of learned after a point, well, stop buying just the, you know, I'd buy $5 shirts, well, they'd only last a year. But it was a $5 shirt. You know, and you know, I'd always have, you know, Dan Brown, he was a good friend. He'd come out, I say, that's a $5 shirt. He goes, yeah, it looks like it. He said, most people wouldn't wear that, but looks good on you. That was one of his favorite lines. Most men don't look good in that, but looks good on you. I guess I'm not most men. like Michael Jackson. So that's in a Thriller video. I wasn't making any other reference. So she's not afraid. Why? And she has quality things. Her husband is known in the gates. He's an important person. Where he sits among the elders of the land, he's respected. Do you know what part of why he's respected? He's got control of his household. Do you respect men that can't control their household? I don't. I never have. Women, men that let women run the show and then tell them how it's going to be, I lose respect for a man the second I see that. Because that's not biblical, right? It's not what the Bible teaches. And so again, while we have to avoid the paterfamilias approach, where by God, I am the law and there is no other, we also have to avoid the hands-off approach of, well, you can do kind of whatever you want and I'm never going to pull you up short. That's not good husbanding. That's not a good marriage either, by the way. So he's respected. What, part of the reason he's respected, again, is his household's under control. He doesn't have this reproach following him around. His kids are brats. His wife is lazy. People know. People recognize. And you say, well, people don't always see everything. No, but we see enough to know. I have a general sense of what's going on. I don't have to know specifics all the time. Don't want to know specifics most of the time, to be honest. So she makes linen garments and sells them. I assume she makes the garments in her house and sells them from there. I don't see any need for her to go out and set up a storefront. And supplies belts to the tradesmen. Strength and dignity are her clothing. And she smiles at the future. She's confident. Because she's doing the right things and God's blessing her and she knows it. She senses that her gain is good. Because it's blessed by God. She opens her mouth in wisdom. And the teaching of kindness is on her tongue. She looks well to the ways of her household. You have a wife that's lazy, sleeps till 10 o'clock, stays up all night playing video games or whatever. Or a husband. I'm not picking just on the women here. Does all that. They're not worth that much. You know, laziness isn't a quality to pursue or promote. And there's all kinds of things about that in Proverbs. About go to the ant, you sluggard. Get off your butt and get busy. This is true for a lot of people. She looks well to the ways of her household, and she does not eat the bread of idleness. Her children rise up and bless her. Her children recognize her goodness, her value in the household, that what a great mother she is. And her husband also praises her, saying, many daughters have done nobly. But you excel them all. This acknowledges there are godly women out there who do these things right. But you pass them all. Charm is deceitful. Really? And beauty is vain. Well, beauty fades, doesn't it? But a woman who fears the Lord. And while he doesn't say this in the beginning stages, undergirding all that he has said is the fear of the Lord. That's what he's taught. He's describing a woman who properly fears the Lord. And she will be praised. Give her the product of her hands. And let her works praise her in the gates. And this is what women end up with, by the way. You'll end up with the product of your hands. You may not be producing anything, but that's what you're going to end up with is nothing. This woman produces. She's productive. And I've never had any complaints in that front. Obviously, because of the physical disability, Linda can't do a lot of the cleaning now and the work. But she did it for years and never complained, never said anything other than, you know. And now that I do some of it, I get it. You know, you mop the floor and they'll go in there and spill something. Huh? I just mopped that. You know, we don't use a mop now. We use Swiffer. But the point is, I get it now that I never, you know, before when I come in, I was dirty and didn't think about it, and I kicked my dirty shoes off, and now I think about it a little bit later. But I've at least grown up and realized, hey, this is the person that does this work doesn't care for you coming in just messing it up. So again, this is the kind of woman you want, guys. And this is again, it was a woman who fears the Lord. How are you going to find one of those? I would look in the bar. or maybe the health club. Find the most fit woman there that's there 5 hours a day. Because that's what you want, right? No, not at all. Her priorities are wrong. Anybody at the gym 5 hours a day, your priorities are wrong. You know, I mean, unless you're training for the Olympics or something, an elite athlete, that's different. But nobody here's elite athletes that I know of. And nobody's training for the Olympics. And most people aren't. So you don't need all that kind of stuff. So again, the real issues, the real blessings in life come to those that honor God. And if a guy and a girl is patient and will wait and pray about this and do these things as set forth in this doctrine, don't cut corners. Don't think you're going to do it by your own strength of effort. You can, but then you may end up with something that's far less than desirable, a contentious woman or a contentious man. So these come to those that honor God and apply His word to those issues. One cannot appeal to this doctrine as a justification. And actually, I'm going to have more to say about this, so I guess we're going to have one more class. I was planning on finishing this today, but there's a lot to say on that front with regard to this issue. I've heard this one just beat up by believers that should know better, but we'll deal with this on Tuesday. Thank you, Heavenly Father, for the opportunity to fellowship in the things of your word. We pray that you would emphasize these principles to us through the Holy Spirit and support these things in our lives as we choose to apply them. For we ask it in Christ's name. Amen.